Cerberus Armory.
What's that smell? Roses?
What smell?
They appeared on a vacant patch of armory floor. One moment there was nothing except the light strips shining from the low ceiling on an open expanse of concrete stained with spilled lubricants and painted with broad red and yellow bands and markings of lost significance, the shelves and racks and piles of crates, dark, silent masses around. Then they were there, 8 humans, 2 women and 6 men, unmistakably aborigines, although 2 of the men were unusually large, as tall as Cain. Dressed not as Bridget Domi and Shizuka had described the aborigines they encountered in Australia not long before, in loincloths and paint, but rather in what appeared standard Western dress. They stepped forward, grinning.
Good eye.
The man who spoke was an exceptionally dark-skinned young man, a little shorter and wirier than the other men. He was dressed in loose red trousers and athletic shoes, a light windbreaker over a white shirt pinstriped pale blue. He had a whole jungle of hair grown into thick dreadlocks and more or less confined within a big, saggy red, yellow, white, and black mushroom of a knit cap. Like several of the others, he had swirls and spirals painted on his cheeks in white.
Good day. Fair dinkum pleasure to be among you. To whom do I present myself first, then? Don't want to ruffle any feathers.
Stone-faced, Grant nudged Cain in the ribs.
Hey, since when am I the leader of this mob?
Didn't say you were the leader. But you are the point man.
Right. I'm Cain.
He stepped forth and stuck out his hard, scarred hand. The teak-colored hand that gripped it in return was as unmarked as an infant's, oddly slim and graceful, in some ways almost reminiscent of a hybrid's. But there was nothing hybrid-like in its firmness. It felt like steel wire wound around a vanadium alloy armature. Cain sensed that if he gave in to the old mag impulse, which he had to admit to himself he had felt, stirred by the almost feminine delicacy of the hand's appearance, and tried the old metacarpal-crushing game, he might be lucky to reel his own digits back unmangled.
A pleasure, Cain. I'm Johnny Corribori, and this here's my mob. We brought a couple of teams with, just the way our old man worked it out with yours. This here's Warboom Ben, my tech boy.
Johnny Corribori indicated a tall man with a knobby face and a dark green ball cap turned backward atop a shag of curly brown hair. He wore a dark green t-shirt with a few narrow, sinuous stripes of black and others of gray that seemed to be intended as camouflage. He wore pants of a different camo pattern, basically desert beige. The copious cargo pouches were bulging with stuff.
Next is my firewalker, who answers to Mary Alice. She conveys us all about this broad blue globe of ours.
Hi.
She was tall for this group, though shorter than Bridget, and slim. Her skin was lighter, almost olive, and her features were finer than those of the others. Her hair, streaming down from beneath a slate-gray beret, was darkest, almost blue-black, pin-dreaded. She wore a lightweight, dusty pink blouse and faded dungarees. Next, Johnny indicated a man of Cain's height, incredibly wide, squared-off shoulders and a chem-drum chest balanced atop a pair of almost comically skinny, bowed legs. He had an incredible scarred badlands for a face and little perceptible neck, so that his long, bearded chin seemed to rest on his clavicle. His eyes were striking yellow.
This is Tyree, my bull boy.
Pleased to meet you.
Johnny put his arm around the shoulders of the next, a man not much taller than he, with dark, dusty red dreads and characteristic aboriginal features, broad nose, prominent brow ridges. He wore khaki cargo shorts and a tan shirt with loops on the shoulder.
And this here's my cobber Billy Handsome. You'll not want for a finer mate, even among this fine lot. In his case, the handsome goes straight down to the bone.
A pleasure.
Billy grinned. Cain could see he was very handsome indeed, even if his appearance was unorthodox by the standards Cain was used to.
I'm talker for our other team, even though Johnny has a tendency to do the talking for us all, and a good number besides. Allow me to present my friends, Nobby, Rita, and Bushbaby Bob. They are my tech boy, firewalker, and bull boy, respectively.
Nobby was a tall, round-faced youth with his brown eyes swimming behind a pair of giant dark-rimmed glasses. What looked like a magnifier attachment was folded away along one wing. Rita was a pretty, sturdy woman with dark blonde dreads reminiscent of Reba DeFore's. Bushbaby Bob was huge, almost as tall as Grant, and wider. Cain, who'd encountered a few Samoans knocking around the Pacific Islands, wondered if he had one or two of those for ancestors. Kane shook hands with all in turn and then introduced his own companions, including Sally Wright, who seemed a natural appendage to the core group, and Phil Boyd, who emphatically was not, but had tagged along because he didn't want to miss anything. The newcomers, even the painfully shy Warboom Ben and the scarcely less shy Mary Alice, were nothing but smiles.
Were they all like this when you were down there, Bridget?
They were cordial, or at least Yindi was, he being the only one we spoke with at length.
And even he was pretty stern. Don't know why they're all so happy all of a sudden.
If you don't mind my asking, how is it you're able to appear here in the middle of the redoubt, as you did?
Johnny Korobori grinned his infectious grin.
Like I told you, it's our firewalkers do the trick.
How do they do it?
Mary Alice and Rita looked at each other. Rita laughed.
It's something of a genetic predisposition, and then again, something of a skill. Not easy to describe in words, especially not English, if you'll pardon my saying so.
You mean you really do just walk through walls?
Oh, yes.
Well, that's not fair.
When did you start expecting life to be fair, partner? In case you've forgotten, that was the whole point of Mags, to make sure life never did become fair. Not that we ever saw much danger it might happen.
But look, Kane, we jump and it turns us inside out. We come out puking up our guts. Them, they traipse through time and space without turning a hair and come out literally smelling like roses.
Since you put it that way, can you teach us that trick?
Johnny Korobori, the apparent Aboriginal leader, flashed his toothpaste-ad smile.
No chance, Cobber. Sorry.
The others were conversing in a fluid alien speech. Listening to them, Bridget's brow slowly furrowed deeper and deeper.
Is that your Anangu language? I can't pretend I learned more than a smattering, but this sounds different from what I heard spoken when we were in Australia before.
The newcomer shared a secret glance.
It is now. It's crew talk.
And whatever might that be?
Why, it's the original language all of us folk you call Aborigine spoke, 75,000 years ago.
How come everywhere we go recently, it's overrun with these damn mutant freak survivors?
Kane whacked at an enormous snake with his machete that dropped its horse-sized head at him from a dead fallen tree that arched over their path. It regarded him with a baleful orange eye as big around as a Kruger ant. It was a true monster, brown with brown lozenges outlined in black running up a body that was not much smaller around than Kane's own. It successfully dodged his cut and recoiled, out of harm's way.
It's not a mutie.
What's that?
I said it's not a mutant, sir.
Kane looked around. The speaker was Warboom Ben, the team's tech boy. How he got a name that implied a voice with some volume to it when he was being so damned diffident was anybody's guess. Maybe it was some kind of ritual thing. Kane waved at the monster.
Got to be. Look at the size of that thing. It'll be 20 feet long at least.
Ben smiled shyly.
Might be even bigger, sir. They were known to grow up 10 meters even before the nuke cast.
I'm going around the tree myself.
Domi had on a khaki shirt, khaki bush shorts, steel-toed boots, and, of all the damn things, a pith helmet. Where she'd found the thing in the Cerberus armory was anybody's guess. She carried in her hands a .308 NATO M14 battle rifle about as long as she was. Kane thought she was taking this jungle girl thing way too far.
Not a mutie?
Kane stared at the snake and felt fresh waves of sweat cascade down his face to join the many layers exertion in the brutal heat and humidity had already laid there. The snake gave back an unwinking orange gaze.
Not at all, sir.
Well, then, nothing to worry about, Domi. Big guy's probably as scared of us as we are of him.
Johnny Korobori strode beneath the python without so much as glancing up to slap Kane on the shoulder.
No, that lot ate people even before the nuke cast. Since that time, we're like a major food group for these blokes. Good job this lad wasn't hungry, eh?
City boys. You can put that silly chopper away, too. The brush here isn't anywhere near thick enough. We have to hack a path through it.
Not on your life. Not after coming face to face with that thing.
By this time, Ben, Mary Alice, and Tyree had all strolled beneath the vast serpent with equal unconcern. So far, their blue beam wonder blasters had been nowhere in appearance. Bringing up the rear, Tyree was toting an altogether conventional AKM assault rifle borrowed from the redoubt's seemingly endless supply. The snake raised its head and laid it onto its twined body, as if the humans were too puny to bother with anyway.
Tell me again why we couldn't just land in downtown Tanimbar City.
the Dewaraja's spies. They lie thick on the ground in Tenimbar. Not so unusual for a major port city.
Dewaraja? What's that mean?
God King.
Kane didn't find particularly appealing the heavy features of most of the Aborigine contingent, including those of Rita, the other Far Walker who was back in North America with Baptiste, Grant, and her three teammates, searching for some kind of mystery artifact. He didn't think they were ugly, just somewhat strange-looking, which, admittedly, was something of an obstacle to acceptance for a man conditioned since birth to regard as suspicious any deviance from what he had been taught to consider standard human appearance. The group's relentless friendliness had begun to eat away at that reservation, even as it had ground on Kane's nerves. But Mary Alice was pretty by Kane's standards. Very pretty. Definitely easy on the eyes. Her presence might go a long way to lighten the load on this fool's mission. He showed her his grin. She paled just a little, and her step faltered briefly. Damn, he thought. Am I that scary? Probably, he admitted. And these folks don't have lots of reason to trust white people, even after all these years.
So, Johnny, how do you know so much about what's going on in Tanimbar City?
Well, our spies are thick on the ground, too. Thank old man for that. And cheer up, the coast is just ahead over this next ridge.
They had jumped, or far-walked, as the Aborigines called it, onto the island a couple of miles back, beside a giant tumble of granite boulders atop a hill rising out of the forest. Kane suspected the rocks served somehow as road marks or anchors for Mary Alice, although quite obviously the Farwalkers didn't require special geomagnetic nodes to function the way Lakesh's interfacers did. But they had offered no explanation, and Kane harbored a suspicion that if either he or Domi asked, they'd get a figurative pat on the head and a smiling, "Hard luck, mate, but you wouldn't understand." Although lush and tropical, the woods weren't exactly jungle. Or maybe they were. Kane was anything but clear on the niceties of what exactly constituted a jungle. It certainly wasn't swamp, like the boggy bayous of the Mississippi Delta in South Samariumville. Although the general lushness and profusion of the foliage indicated they obviously didn't stint on rainfall hereabouts, the drainage was evidently pretty good. Their elevation had been steadily, if subtly, declining since they left the rock clump and made their way between alternating stands of trees and undergrowth-choked clearings.
So, why are you people so different, anyway?
Obviously, she was somewhat weirded out by the whole experience, despite her carefully maintained air of jaunty unconcern. She was lapsing sporadically back toward the elliptic outlander speech she'd grown up with.
When Bridget and I went to Uluru before, everybody was dancing, naked, except paint and loincloths, mostly paint. Dancing and doing Aunquilfa.
Kane grinned at the way the Anangu word for magic slipped effortlessly from her tongue. She and her companions had had some knowledge of the language inserted directly in their minds via the strange dream time by the shaman Yindi. He also grinned at the way Shizuka's name didn't cross the albino woman's tongue at all. Although sharing danger had reconciled them somewhat from mortal enemy status, they had apparently not progressed to the inviting each other for sleepovers stage.
We woke up.
Tari's long, craggy face, even more scarred than Kane's own, smiled. But the expression didn't touch his lynx-yellow eyes.
Why couldn't we at least have come out on the beach, then?
Got to be careful how we approach the people hereabouts. Touchy blokes.
And who might they be?
Sea Dyaks.
And what are they, headhunters?
Something whirred past his right elbow to thunk and stand quivering in the squat, pineapple-like bowl of a cycad. Kane had to stare at it for a couple of heartbeats before the optic center of his brain made sense of it. Yes, a dart, carved of pale yellow wood or even middling fresh bone with a twist of white plant fiber for a flight. Johnny took three steps closer to Kane as small dark-skinned men with white skull faces painted over their own features rose from the undergrowth all around them.
Why, yes they are. Now, how'd you guess that, mate?
It's a turtle.
What?
Nobby, the round-faced tech boy, cringed.
Don't let his lack of manners intimidate you. He's just gruff by nature.
Do let my manners intimidate you if you know what's good for you. You didn't just tell us we came all the way out here to look for a turtle, did you?
Yeah.
Flashlight beams crisscrossed ahead of them, illuminating floating motes, some with wings. They were in the death-dark corridor of the storage area of a derelict museum beneath the mounded rubble of the erstwhile University of Wisconsin at Madison, and being ultra-cautious. Their own monitoring of traffic within and among the nine baronies had turned up reports from Palladiumville's Mag Division indicating a nasty bunch of canny scavengers claimed the turf as their own. Maybe, maybe not. Bridget didn't doubt there were nasty things about, probably lurking right around that next turn in the corridor or in one of the empty doorways. There always were in the Outlands, she had learned. She swept the corridor with a magistrate-issue Nighthawk microlight. Grant used the light-gathering visor on his hard-contact armor. Instant escape was available if Rita had even a second to concentrate on her mystic ability, but in case of trouble, fight would be more important than flight. They didn't want to have to go back to any place they'd been, so if trouble found them, they'd hang and bang as long as they could. Speed and firepower were their tools more than stealth. More than a little mindful of Kane's adventure getting shot while wearing shadow armor in the Palladiumville pits, Grant had opted to go the hard-shell route. He cradled a copperhead in his polycarbonate-gauntleted hands. Bridget carried a 9mm Heckler & Koch Universal Service pistol, true double-action and holstered with one round loaded and 15 more in the double-stack magazine. Her Kevlar vest, with a steel-ceramic laminate trauma plate in the middle of it, was stiff and chafed a bit under her arms. But under the circumstances, such as not having to hump the damn thing over miles of Outlands to get to a getaway and back to the relative safety of Cerberus Redoubt, she was glad of the protection it offered, if extremely conscious of the fact that its coverage was far from complete.
Okay, I'll go along with the gag. We're looking for a turtle. What kind of turtle? Does it bite, or is that information classified too?
Sorry, Mike. Don't mean to play things too close to our vests. It's a figurine of a turtle too, right? Rita, can you be a love and show off friends?
No worries.
Rita, though far less outgoing than Billy, was less reticent than her fellow farwalker, Mary Alice. She stopped in mid-hallway, half-turned, raised a hand palm up and partially cupped. Golden light streamed upward from the pale skin of her palm, illuminating spidery metal braces holding up the high ceiling. In the light funnel, an image took form, a stylized figurine of a turtle, as advertised, about 3 inches long and 2 wide, head up and rotating slowly like a 3D display of a computer-assisted drafting program. It appeared to be made of rich green stone, smooth and lustrous, veined with hints of black and dark yellow or lighter green.
Damn.
The McKinsey Turtle. He is what we're looking for. A ritual artifact? It appears to be made of malachite.
So it does. It's the most important thing on Earth to us right about now.
If the evil ones you call barons get their hands on it, the results could be disastrous for your people and ours.
We'll do anything to find it, and get it back as soon as possible to Lilga.
Lilga?
It means morning star.
It's a little girl.
Our national treasure.
Can we move this along?
Grant sidled over beside Bridget with the muzzle brake of his copperhead tipped toward the low, water-stained acoustic tile ceiling.
This is all real interesting, but we don't know how long we got down here before we attract company.
Don't you think we might spend less time searching if we had a better idea what we were searching for?
Fine.
Nobby stuck his head out a side door.
Might be worth checking in here.
Billy, let's you and me just hang here outside the door and keep an eye out.
Too right.
Snap it up in there. Hairs on the back of my neck are starting to rise.
It'll take as long as it takes.
Rita wore an apologetic smile. Her face was a black-and-white nightmare mask in Grant's light-enhancing visor.
Tough roads, eh?
Inside the storeroom, it was even mustier than the corridor outside, as well as seeming darker. Bridget could just imagine herself inhaling clouds of mildew spores with each intake of air. It was like trying to breathe soup. She tried to track Rita's gaze with her microlight beam. There was some disorder. Inevitably, a few shelves toppled, objects displaced onto the floor and now obscured by cobwebs and drifting dust. But nothing not likely explainable by war and earth tremors. There was no sign of the systematic scavenging that had struck so many other pre-Skydark sites. There had to be nothing here to attract looters, or 10 whole generations of scavvies and roamers. Either that, or the museum basement was too well guarded.
If I knew a bit more about the turtle's history, maybe I could be of some actual use.
Phew! Ooh! Almost lost a piece of my soul there, and only just after getting it put back to rights, too.
Bridget cocked her head quizzically. Rita answered her question in a way that seemed hurried.
The McKinsey turtle is one of the very few examples of Aboriginal sculpture the Euros ever found.
She said something to Nobby then, in the tongue Johnny claimed was his people's original one. The tech boy answered in a subdued tone, head tipped forward, eyes down.
A Scots naturalist named Angus McKinsey discovered it on the Kimberley Plateau in Western Australia in 1843. As no doubt you know was common in those days, he promptly made off with it.
She cleared a mass of cobwebs from a small object on a shelf at about her own eye level. It proved to be a fragment of pottery. In the bad light, Bridget could tell no more about it.
The turtle found its way to North America by the latter half of the 19th century as part of an ethnographic collection. Unfortunately, even that knowledge is incomplete. We don't know which collection or where, and we lost track of it altogether right after. Nothing to go on but hints, none of which has panned out so far.
Is there any chance it might have been destroyed?
None. Old man feels it's still in this world, and Yindi concurs. But sadly, not even their doings are enough to pin it down.
I'm sure you know your affairs best. But has it occurred to you that rummaging through museum shelves might not be your optimal search mode? What about records?
Computerized records are pretty much beyond all reach, what with the new cost and salvaging and all. We go through paper records when we find them. It's a bloody task as well, I'm afraid.
But computerized records aren't beyond our reach. The Baronies have made a concerted effort to collect everything they can of digitized records. I was an archivist. It was my job to collate such data, which definitely did include things like records of museum collections. At this stage, where we should be is back in Cerberus, scanning through what's available there. Over the years, Lakesh managed to siphon a great deal of information out of Historical Division storage.
Rita stared at her with wide eyes. Then her face broke into a smile.
See? Old man was right when he said we needed you lot. Come on then, let's collect the others and...
And suddenly, the sibilant threatening whispers were all around them, like a cloud of disturbed moths.
What the hell is that?
He says the God King's hiring mercenaries to attack Oz. They're using that as cover, that they're going there to enlist, same as we are.
Johnny Korobori stood with one boot up on the sprit of the sailing ship, hobbyhorsing along across a bright blue-green sea. Domi was standing on the foredeck behind Kane.
What are they going to do when we get there?
You know, I don't rightly know. Probably sign on as mercenaries.
I thought they hated the God King and his minions.
Oh, they do. Too right. But he pays in good gold, and they can always desert. Besides, they seldom shy away from a good scrape, these lads. Just the opposite, in fact.
Next to Johnny stood a roguish-looking young man wearing a red and yellow turban, scarlet pantaloons, and a yellow sash with an alarming weapon like a saber with a bifurcated tip thrust through it. His chest was covered with scrolled tattoos of a tree with outspread wings above it and palm fronds flanking it. A narrow beard and mustache fringed his somewhat sensual-lipped mouth and square jaw. Like most of his men, who were mostly gawking at Domi's bare, milk-white legs, in addition to the sword, he also wore a dagger with a curved hilt and a nasty, wavy, straight-tipped blade. He gestured off to sea, at the red triangular sail billowing and booming overhead in the crisp, salt-scented breeze, and then at the green-furred land masses humping up like a convention of mossy-backed sea serpents inland past the blinding white beaches.
Bendera Mera says if the wind stays in this quarter, we should rise Tanimbar City by mid-afternoon.
Bendera Mera?
He's the captain. Name means red flag.
Johnny flicked his dark eyes upward to the long forked pennon snapping at the jackstaff.
Taken from his personal banner.
These people sure do like red.
Domi turned to survey the crew. They returned the favor with an intensity that did not make Kane altogether comfortable. He reminded himself that the Iban, as the Sea Dyaks called themselves, had no body armor, and he had his Sin Eater tucked away out of sight. As well as the Aborigine quartet for backup, who, with the exception of Tyree, as obvious a cold heart as Kane would ever care to lay eyes on, admittedly did not seem too formidable. Yet a team much like this one had blasted a passel of Palladiumville mags to smoking carcasses.
Tough bunch of bastards. Good looking, too.
For hell's sake, don't go screwing any of them.
It's not like you're interested. Why hell you care?
We don't know what the damn ramifications might be.
He glanced at Johnny Korobori, who appeared to be silently laughing his fool head off at them. I probably would be too, Kane reckoned, under the circumstances. That didn't soften his spike of irritation that much.
What?
Don't rightly know, truth to tell. You could well be right.
Domi sulked. She still had her Jungle Explorer regalia on. Her M14 was slung over her shoulder, indicating she felt relatively secure, but wisely did not wish to let it out of her reach. Aside from being unwieldy for one of her small stature, it was a heavy piece of ironmongery, originally designed to fire high-powered .308 cartridges full-auto, which hers could not do, since it had proved near impossible for men the size and strength of Grant to control the blasters on full rock and roll, and they had been converted to pure semi-auto long before Skydark. Yet she bore it, as she bore the astounding heat and humidity, without the slightest sign of wilting. Just as her gammon beauty and frankly slutty effect made it easy to underestimate her intelligence, her slight size made it easy to forget that she had been born and raised in the rawest outlands hell, where the weak never got a first chance, never mind a second. For his part, Kane wore dark blue pantaloons, a loose yellow blouse with his sin-eater in its power holster strapped out of sight within one voluminous sleeve, a blue head rag, and loose-topped boots of soft yellow leather. He had no idea how the Sea Dyaks had come up with the garments, since he stood a good head above the tallest of them. Given what he'd learned of them, he was none too sure he wanted to find out. Tyree came swaggering up, wearing nothing but a loincloth and a good coating of sweat. He'd been practicing grappling with Ebon warriors on the high poop deck.
They're not bad folk, if you can get past the beheadings.
Beheadings?
Even Domi's scarlet eyes widened beneath the brim of her pith helmet.
They're really headhunters, mate.
These are our allies?
Like you haven't killed a few hundred people.
Never cut their heads off. Well, not after they were dead. Except maybe once or twice. But I don't take trophies, okay?
Think about some of the things the people you used to work for do.
Oh, shut up.
An image of his father, bound in unending servitude in the nightmare caverns of Area 51, flashed through his mind. Possibly sensing something of the conversation's drift, Red Flag spoke earnestly to Johnny, trying to reassure his guests that his people weren't cannibals.
The fact that he feels compelled to do so isn't real reassuring in itself.
Johnny shrugged.
Well, there are some that are. Some just ritually. Some because, well, you know, they rather got the taste when times were tough.
Kane looked out to sea, as if expecting to see the blood-red triangular sail of a cannibal ship rise like a shark fin above the horizon. Their ship had scarlet sails. Why shouldn't the cannibals? Domi elbowed Kane's ribs.
What? Don't fuse. We got cannies back home.
Yeah, and they're not my favorite play pals either.
Whatever. All this talk makes me hungry. What do they got to eat on board here?
Jesus.
What?
Never mind.
A fresh crowd of Iban wandered forward. They had been watching the wrestling match between the Aborigine bull boy and their own champion. From the way Tyree held himself and the way the homeboys were acting, Kane gathered the Aborigine had got the better of it, but only slightly. He also suspected really strongly that that outcome was just exactly what the scarred, almost yellow-skinned man intended, to display dominance without humiliating the locals on whom their mission, not to mention their lives, currently depended. The Australians acted like nothing so much as a bunch of happy puppies. Yet at the same time, Kane sensed that beneath that bouncy exterior lay bones as hard and durable as the vanadium steel of a redoubt. They had already displayed quick wits and unswerving determination, not to mention the odd, unnerving power. And, of course, the still unseen miracle blasters they'd used to torch the Palladiumville mags. Unfortunately, this new lot of pirate spectators had got a good testosterone dump into their systems watching all the macho horseplay aft. They started crowding around the bare-armed and legged Domi, jostling one another and tossing jocular comments at each other in melee. Kane thought he caught an edge to their banter, and it was getting sharper, like a blade held sparking to a grinding wheel.
Johnny, we may have a situation developing here.
I've never seen a woman quite like her. It's got their interest running high, I won't lie to you.
It's not as if they haven't seen female skin before.
They had passed the night in the Sea Dyak village, where many of the women wore little more than skirts and occasional tattoos. Some of the younger ones, Kane had noticed with a certain discomfort, were definitely easy, even on his North American eyes.
Maybe they think I'm a goddess because of my white skin and red eyes.
No. We're done with that. Don't even say that. Johnny, don't they notice she's wearing a long blaster bigger than she is? They know blasters, don't they?
Johnny shrugged. His perpetual smile seemed to be getting a mite taut and glassy.
Too well, mate. And they respect their power, believe you me. What they tend not to respect is people who depend on him to do their fighting for them.
Maybe you should head below decks and see what Nuri Alice is doing.
Might too late for that.
The all but imperceptible edge to Johnny's voice was as loud an alarm as any Kane had heard in his life.
What they do respect is edged weapons.
Tyree, the big aborigine, was toweling his scarred hide dry with a startlingly fluffy and clean white towel. His manner was relaxed, and his mouth smiled, but his tiger's eyes were open wide, and he swiveled his head constantly from side to side. Kane knew instinctively the bull boy's eyes were in soft focus mode, to take in the widest possible field of vision, probably well past 180 degrees. Magistrates were trained to do it, too. You couldn't see detail for shit, but any movement whatever, especially what was known and loved in the ancient vernacular as a false move, stood out like a railway flare. A bell rang in the back of his brain.
Edged weps.
On it, Kane.
Suddenly, metal glinted in her little bone-white fist. 9 inches of nasty, serrated knife blade. As always, she had been carrying it out of sight, which she could do, seemingly, when clad in nothing but her pet red stand-ups. Another one of those mysteries Kane had decided he really didn't want to solve. The encroaching mob of headhunting pirates stopped, took a collective step back, and uttered an appreciative, ooh. She twirled the blade expertly and stuck it deftly through the belt of her shorts. The Iban applauded. The crowd began to break up, chattering a lot more relaxedly to itself.
Well, that looks like one more massacre averted. Good move, Domi.
Of course.
That's something about you, Domi. No false modesty. Nor real modesty, either.
She grinned wider.
What's the story here, Johnny? I thought the new cost pretty much wiped out this part of the globe.
Right you are, mate.
Johnny nodded toward Warboom Ben, who stood with his back to the rail and his dark eyes lemur large. Nerd or no, he wasn't too otherworldly to smell the potential bloodbath that had passed them by.
Ben's the man to listen to from here. Come on, lad, give us a story, then.
The tech boy stepped forward tentatively.
Nobody suffered so much devastation from the nuke cast and its aftermath, probably, as the folks of the South Seas. What with the tsunami and the great volcano blasts and all, especially the Rabaul one. Whole islands, whole archipelagos were just scoured clean like that.
Domi gestured to the land they sailed along. Beyond a broad strip of beach gleaming so white it pained the eyes, rose tall palms, and beyond them lush green undergrowth cut off deeper penetration of vision.
Like here, you mean?
Right. It was bad here, even though they had the mass of New Guinea to soak up the worst of it. But this is a good place for life, fertile environment. It came back even where it had departed completely, don't you see? By wind and water, by seeds dropped in bird shit, if nothing else.
He had an unusually strong grasp of the humanistic realm of history for a gearhead, Kane thought. He kept it to himself. It was dawning on him that these people perceived and compartmented, for lack of a better word, reality in a way much different than he did. Which should not surprise him, given what Baptiste had told of her experiences with Uluru and Dreamtime. Except their behavior didn't match up with what she had seen and learned, and he knew that bothered her. It didn't seem to impinge upon their survival. Not so far as he could see, anyway. So he was content to let things flow as they would. For now.
Same way with the people. The Malay, the Polynesians. They sprang from the greatest seafarers this planet ever saw. And even when the balloon went up in what you call your 20th century, a great many of them still lived in close harmony with the great Mother Ocean. So although 100 million died in a day, an instant, a large proportion of the survivors took to the sea and rode the storm out there. Then they came back, and even despite the darkening of the skies, began to re-establish themselves right away.
How do you know all this?
Old man, mostly. Old man, he knows most everything that goes on in the world. He's watched.
How come the women didn't meet this old man when they went to Uluru before?
Warboom Ben blinked and sucked his head down between his shoulders. Kane realized he had no reference to the question, that though he probably understood the words, he could make little sense of them, and that made the tech boy acutely uncomfortable.
Because he didn't choose to show himself to them like enough.
From above came a cry as piercing as that of a seagull. Kane didn't understand the words, but there was no mistaking its crackling urgency. The assembled sea dyaks reacted as if lightning had just struck the mainmast. They scattered in all directions like a covey of purposeful quail. Swords and pole arms of a bewildering variety of sizes and shapes appeared in hard brown hands, and round, curved shields were strapped on forearms. Great saggy nets were unfurled from the gunwales up the lines guying the mast.
What? Pirates?
Thought we were the pirates.
Even sharks fear bigger sharks.
Well, for now, it's nothing but a sail poking over the horizon off the starboard bow.
Which means?
Anything from sweet damn all to enslavement or torturous death.
What do we do?
We roll the bones, Les. Well, that's life all over, isn't it? We roll the bones.
What's that smell?
Shit.
Human.
The whispering was solidifying, acquiring cadence, chanting, Rigid thought. Then coalescing into words, low, slurred, barely intelligible, perhaps learned by ancient rote and repeated, liturgy-like, with no real knowledge of what the words themselves once meant. The three were turning circles amid the dusty shelves, looking all around and up at the dropped tile ceiling, trying to figure out where the voices were coming from.
I don't fancy the trend this talk is taking.
Bridget sub-vocalized for the benefit of her contact chip implanted beneath the skin over her larynx.
Grant?
I hear it. What's it mean?
Trouble. Rita, I think we should get out of here now. We can work more efficiently back at Cerberus anyway. Ask Johnny.
The call is mine, my friend. He knows my choice. So does Bob. He comes now. But we must all be together before...
The grill over a ventilation duct blew in as if dynamited, practically over her beret-clad head. She ducked. Bridget caught a flash of a pallid animalistic form, of gaping toothy jaws and outstretched talons, already in flight for her face. By reflex, she pushed her microlight and her USP out to an isosceles position, inner wrists crossed, and squeezed off two shots, the quickest controlled fire possible. Then she sidestepped, remembering another nuance of hand blaster combat drilled into her by Kane and Grant and reinforced by experience. The bullets wouldn't stop a body in rapid motion. The white figure crashed against a rack of metal shelving and toppled it, setting off a domino chain as it took down three more sets of shelves with it. Artifacts bouncing and smashing on the floor in a tumult of noise and dust. The creature itself thrashed on the floor, spraying blood everywhere in a wild arterial fan, snarling and snapping at itself like a dog hit by a truck. It was the size of a large human child or a very small adult. It appeared to be new, although Bridget couldn't tell, with the bad light and its convulsive movement, what gender it was. Nobby raised his right hand, which proved to contain an altogether ordinary 40-caliber baby Glock 27. He fired a single shot and blew the narrow, snouted skull apart. Techie he might be, and reticent when not discussing his specialty, yet he chilled the thing with the aplomb of the most seasoned Stoneheart. Bridget had no time to mull apparent contradictions in the young man's character. The creatures were pouring out of the gaping vent shaft as if a tap had been opened, leaping, capering, scrambling over shelves, fallen or still upright, circling them, and all were chanting. They came in sight of Tanimbar City instants after the swollen sun dissolved in an ocean like a pool of blood. The sail sighted had been white, belonging to a merchantman, whose consuming interest, once her lookouts had in turn spotted the sea dyak's scarlet sail, had been to get as far and fast away as possible from the oncoming pirate vessel. There were more than a few, no more than semi-jocular curses and dark-eyed glances of disappointment cast after the sail as it vanished back below the horizon, cutting as close to the wind as its lateen-rigged mainsail would permit. The swords and bucklers and pole arms had been reluctantly racked or thrust back through sashes. Kane had observed that the blowpipes the Iban had first used to announce their presence to the party had not been in evidence. Tyree spoke up.
They use poison. It acts slowly, and a single dart won't carry enough to kill a grown man, at least not with any consistency.
What good is it, then?
Tyree grinned.
Put yourself in the boots of an invader crashing through their bush. Dart comes out of nowhere, hits your mate. You and the rest of your party go all mad minute, bust caps in every conceivable direction. Does no good, of course. Even if you hit the bloke with the blowgun, you'll likely never find him.
What he's telling us is the pipes aren't much use in a stand-up gunfight.
Yeah, I got that.
Domi then stamped off in search of more to eat. Now, with the night gathering about them like a heavy black cloak, the horizon still a line of fire, underlighting a squall line of clouds colored like a bruise, yellow and purple and green and black, they passed a spit of land crusted with dark palm trees, and the city appeared. The fairyland of twinkling yellow and orange and crimson lights, dark ramparts and towers and minarets seemed to float upon the waters of the bay.
It's beautiful.
Then the smell hit her like a club. Keen craned over the rail to see a bottle bob past, shouldered aside by the felucca's wake, in the midst of a brownish-seeming stain on the dark wine water.
Sewage bloom. Guess the hybrids haven't installed the same sort of environmental regs they have back home, if they really run the show here.
Oh, they do, Copper. No worries there. They surely do.
The muffled rapping of Bridget's 9mm double tap was echoed by a boom from along the darkened corridor in the direction they'd come. Then a second and a third echoing out of the stairwell.
Bush baby Bob's soul beset.
Billy's tone was as if he actually saw what was befalling his comrade, not making an inference, if a blazingly obvious one, from the aural evidence of the shotgun blasts. Grant was swiveling his whole body side to side from the waist, Copperhead held muzzle up, keeping face and eyes locked rigidly ahead as if he were a solid slab from hips up. He was trained to shoot by reflex in the direction he was looking. Staying connected, as the itinerant Chinese internal martial artist Master Chen put it, kept his body indexed properly to make shots fast and make them count.
He need help?
He can take care of himself. That being his line of country, I reckon the question's more...
Up and down the corridor from them, the grills went flying off vent shafts on either wall. White shapes began to slop forth from them and lope toward the two men, hissing their half-intelligible speech and waving clawed hands like apes. At the same time, a white tide of distorted bipedal figures, moon-white, washed toward them from the shadow-lost depths of the corridor's far end. Billy shrugged, and the two micro-Uzi machine pistols he wore in shoulder holsters beneath each armpit appeared in his hands.
What say you take right?
As he spoke, he pivoted left. Twin ruby beams sprang from the blasters in his fists. The shambling horde of humanoid figures paused in momentary bewilderment.
You got it.
Grant's own laser aiming beam stabbed out as he turned clockwise. He had already switched his fire selector to full auto. This was your basic target-rich environment, close targets. He could smell not just human shit, but a scent at once sweeter and far more repellent, not to mention unsettling. The heavy, cloying stench of rotting human flesh. The Copperhead erupted dancing fire and hammering noise. The pale figures shrieked in terror and anguish as needle-like 4.85mm bullets tore through their naked, filthy bodies. They fell slashing at the air with long, black-nailed hands, scarlet pennons of blood unfurling from their bodies. Ropey strands of pink bloodshot saliva trailed from their inhumanly long, fanged jaws. Grant let his whole magazine go in one shuddering volley, sweeping the blazing blaster in a figure-eight pattern in the dense air before him. Even over the racket, Grant could hear the slightly out-of-phase yammer of Billy's twin autoblasters at his back. The talker had his arms stretched out to just short of elbow lock, wrists crossed, and the backs of his hands pressed against each other for mutual support against the recoil of the short-barreled blasters. Though the rounds they fired were substantially less potent than the bottleneck high-power cartridges Grant's blaster digested, by themselves, each made even more noise. The energy of rapidly expanding gases the Copperhead used to ram bullets down the grooves of its much longer barrel came bellowing out the muzzles of the handblaster-sized micro-Uzis in the form of pure blast. For a moment, noise and carnage ruled the subterranean corridor, then slammed down a silence that throbbed in the ears and very temples like high blood pressure pulse. The groans and involuntary gurgles of the torn and dying hardly scratched the surface of that silence. They were as sounds heard through thick glass. Even with hearing protectors built into his hard contact helmet, Grant was all but deafened. He heard a distinct metallic snick behind him and half turned. Billy Handsome had holstered his left-hand blaster and dropped the empty box out of the butt of the other for a rapid reload from a mag carrier at his waist. Billy grinned over his shoulder at Grant.
Not much stomach for a fair fight, eh?
The white figures that hadn't fallen to the multiple barrages had vanished, ducking into side passages or scrambling in noisy terror back into the open vents. The reek of death and burned propellant and lubricants was enough to turn the stomach of a mag inured to years of PPP.
Nothing fair about it. Just the way I like it.
Bridget!
Grant spun, trying not to wince. If the people inside fired in panic, these walls wouldn't stop a bullet. His hard contact armor would protect him, probably, but Billy had no armor Grant could see, and warm, fuzzy sentiments aside, Grant enthusiastically did not want to lose the firepower of those twin hand blasters. As far as he was concerned, the canny creatures weren't through with them. They were only hunkering down and waiting for their chance, one he fervently hoped they never got. But no stray shots punched through the cinder block, painted maroon to the height of Grant's sternum, and what had probably once been dingy yellow above. Instead, Rita burst through the door, reloading her own hand blaster, which to Grant's quick but expert glance looked like a Makarov. It was a decent piece, but underpowered for serious social work, maybe midway between 380 and standard 9mm Parabellum. A moment later, and Bridget burst out, hair unbound like a flame halo, holding her still-lit Nighthawk and her H&K out before her like the blazing torch and sword of righteousness. Nobby backed out last, aiming back into the storeroom a piece that Grant had first thought might be the famed Mystery Blaster. A longer look told him that no, it was a Vector, a late 20th century South African design that, while it had a definite Buck Rogers look to it, and if he recalled right, a weird triangular front sight, was a thoroughly conventional 9mm semi-auto hand blaster.
What the hell were those things?
Glad to see you're intact too, Grant. Degenerate humans is my best guess.
Then Bridget stopped and stared in wide-eyed shock at the corridor, its floor littered with torn-open corpses and greasy, unreeled guts, the walls hosed with black-looking blood, trails of runny excrement drooling down from the yawning vents.
We did a little redecorating. Can you get us the hell out of here, Rita?
Where's Bob? Can't leave without him.
The chanting began again, an indistinct murmur. It held an edge of rage that had not been audible before.
Are you sure about that?
I won't leave him. And we all have to be in contact to walk far.
More echoing blasts erupted from the stairwell they had descended, now accompanied by brief yellow flashes. Bushbaby Bob backed down the stairs, jacking shots from his bulky Spaz riot gun with machine-like speed. Ghost faces peered down at them. Sinuous tongues licked yellow fangs.
They're above us!
The harbor was packed so tightly that the ships riding to anchor within the shelter of a long mole, made, so Warboom Ben claimed, from baskets full of the rubble of pre-Skydark cities carried on the backs of conscript laborers during the first days of the God King's reign, that their hulls looked like one solid landmass and their masts a dense forest. Red lights glowed from the tops of lofty structures, perilous-looking, even in pitch dark, that truly put the castle in stern castle. Flames danced pale blue and gold above fire pots full of hot coals, providing the illusion of an army encamped in that imaginary forest. Although not wholly illusion, since if they weren't the fires of an invading army, they were the fires of a mighty invasion fleet, to Kane it made no kind of sense to burn open fires on craft made of kindling, with immense sheets of readily flammable cloth slung in webs of equally ready-to-burn ropes right above them. But every tub bigger than a dinghy sported its cheery blaze, and larger vessels more than one. Threads of tinkling music and nasal song wove through the high night air. They vied with the sounds of drunken revelry. The mingled smoke of all the fires, plus undoubtedly many of the lights visible mounting in tiers up a hillside in the city beyond, hung like a fog bank down to just about the level of Kane's head if he stood well forward in the reared-up bow, which contributed mightily to his standing somewhat back. Jostling for room in the crowded air were likewise the smell of curry and spices less identifiable, roasting meat, tobacco and ban, the cinnamon and hot alcohol of mulled wine.
Why anybody would drink hot wine in this sauna is way beyond me.
Kane tried not to flinch as the pirate prow ran so close under one skyward-tumbling stern, its bowsprit nearly poked gilt from one of the demons wielding huge scimitars carved among the fancy scrollwork ocean waves. With the anchorage too crowded for sailing, and the wind blocked by hundreds of hulls besides, the sea dyaks had furled the sails and unshipped the sweeps, and now rode the craft at the pace of a brisk walk. It seemed recklessly fast to Kane, especially since they had only a bullseye lantern hung from the sprit to light their way, which cast its jaundiced beam a good 4 feet at least. Johnny shrugged.
Thy gustibus non disputandum est.
What the hell's that mean?
Of taste and sense, there's no arguing. Latin, mate.
100 yards or so across the water, a tongue of yellow fire spurted up as a drunken carouser kicked over a fire pot. Laughter and merry catcalls turned to cries of distress as flames ran up a slanting line like phosphorescent rats. Somebody hurled a bucket of water onto the coals, which had the effect of distributing them wider across the deck without necessarily extinguishing them. A huge cloud of steam obscured the area where the coals were scattered, although they gave it an interesting orange underlighting. Outraged choking cries from the afflicted vessel and wild calls of laughter from neighboring decks suggested to Kane that some idiot in the grip of fire zone panic had hit the coals with the contents of a honey bucket, not a water vessel.
What's to keep the blaze from sweeping this whole anchorage like, well, wildfire?
Johnny clapped him jovially on the shoulder.
Sweet bugger all, mate.
Kane looked around for Domi. Normally, she'd be even twitchier than he was. From the sound of her laughter falling like rain from above, she was up in the crow's nest with some of the crew. Kane thought he'd seen Warboom Ben scrambling up the precarious rope ladder with her, which allayed his fears somewhat. He suspected, possibly on the basis of wishful thinking, that the shy tech boy would tend to act as chaperone. Johnny lightly touched his forearm with two fingers, the left one without the Sin Eater. With his other hand, he pointed off across the harbor. Kane's first thought was that his worst fancies had come true and the biggest ship in the whole damn harbor was fully involved in flames. Then he realized it was with the lights of lanterns that the giant multi-decked vessel was ablaze. Yes, and something more.
Tell me that's not electric light shining through those windows or portholes or whatever the hell you call them.
I cannot tell a lie, Cobber. That they are. Yonder lies the mighty Varuna, stately pleasure barge to the God King his very self. And covert hydrofoil. She does have masts, but under all plain sail will be pressed to keep up with a glacier.
Looks more like a floating gaudy house to me.
Since he had never seen a pre-dark wedding cake, nor a 19th century Mississippi River paddlewheel steamboat, gaudy house was a fairly close call. All gleaming white hull with multiple decks outlined in gilt, and yellowish-white artificial light spilling out myriad openings, the ship did resemble a gaudy house, an exceptionally large and prosperous one. It dwarfed even the largest war junk.
If we could just put a good volley of shrikes into the son of a bitch, we could all go home to the land of climate-controlled air and hygiene. Plus, all of Cerberus won't burn down every time some triple-stoop drunk waltzes into a charcoal grill. Ugh. Never thought I'd be nostalgic for that gloomy hole on the planet.
No joy. His Nibs has no doubt shifted his palace away from home away up the hill there.
That'd be the great big place that looks like a gaudy house overlooking the whole city.
Right.
I don't suppose Mary Alice could pop us back for a few man-packed missile launchers.
Sadly but firmly, the talker shook his dreads.
Not and live. The God King has some special defenses, of a kind I'm sure you're well aware of, and possibly some you're not. There's no easy way out of this one, I fear.
Is there ever?
White males? There aren't any white males here, you stoops.
He gazed down as the figure he had shot slammed into a wall and rolled bubbling onto its back. Its sharp-featured, almost muzzled face was the white of sun-bleached bone, the same shade as Domi's face. But unlike Domi, the eyes staring through the tracery of blood that covered the face like a veil were the blue of spring sky.
Except you!
I doubt they even know what they're saying.
Bridget put her back to his and slammed a new mag home in the butt of her USP. She had already cycled through the old one, winnowing ghouls from their bracework perches overhead. At corridor's end, Bush Baby Bob had run out of shells. Creatures piled onto him. He reached back, grabbed a gibbering form clinging to his shoulders by its naked nape. He flung it against the wall. Then, reversing his grip on the long blaster, he swung it as if it were an axe, staving in a narrow skull stranded with hair like wisps of optic fiber. Grant's copperhead ran dry as another creature hit the floor ahead of him and bounced straight at his throat. He let it fall by the long sling looped around his neck and met the ghoul with an overhand right. With the most satisfying crunch of bone and teeth, the thing's face imploded. Blood squirted black around Grant's armored fist.
Rita, we can't hold them.
Grant managed to stave off another leaping horror with a hand to its sternum. It hissed and gnashed at the slick armor of his forearm, leaving trails of slobber. The butt of Bob's shotgun was clotted with blood and spilled brains. It flung trails of gore and tissue bits across the walls as he flailed at his attackers. He laid them waste in serious profusion, but they were too many, too fired by fury at the intrusion and the lust to sink their fangs into sweet human meat. They swarmed over him like giant maggots, biting, clawing, clubbing with misshapen fists, doing as much damage to one another and themselves as to the huge aborigine. He sank to his knees.
Nobby, somebody help him!
The tech boy stood with his back to the wall, eyes round on his round face. Then his jaw set, and his right hand dived into the black fanny pack strapped around his waist. The hallway filled with uncanny blue radiance. Grant saw it on the walls to either side, saw it splash the ceiling high overhead, saw it cast his more than man-sized shadow across suddenly cringing ranks of attackers.
Bridget, get down!
Bridget simply dropped. A pale beast leaping at her sailed fortuitously over her head to slam into the wall with a crunch of finality. She and her companions, she saw, were surrounded by a sphere of subtly pulsating blue light, veined with thin, undulating circles. A rod of brilliant blue lanced forth. Thunder, louder than all the blasters going off together, threatened to split Bridget's eardrums. The back of the white beast at the top of the writhing mound, hiding Bush Baby Bob from view, blossomed like a horrible fast-motion flower, red and white around a globe of white brilliance. She looked over her shoulder. Nobby held a blaster that looked like a cross between a hand blaster and the hilt of a 17th-century rapier, a central mass surrounded by loops of curved rods whose convolutions her eyes refused to follow with any degree of closeness. Although the ring of the muzzle itself was a circle of actinic glare, the blue glow seemed to emanate from the blaster as a whole. Bracing firing hand with his other, Nobby discharged the weapon once more. Again a blinding bolt, and again a crack like lightning strike right at Bridget's side. The blue glow flared. Nobby took a step back as if from recoil. The pale-skinned creatures shrank back, covering their snouted faces and squalling in ecstasies of terror. They piled off Bob as if the vid of them overwhelming him were being run backward at unnatural speed. Some fled back into side rooms or vents or leaped back to the girders with inhuman strength. Others merely cowered against the walls, as if not even terror of the awesome light that killed was enough to drive them off, with the smell of their fellow's spilled blood filling their distended nostrils. Nobby raised his blaster toward the shadowed ceiling. The blue glow died.
Bob?
It stirred. Using the Franke scattergun as a crutch, it began painfully to lever itself to its feet. Rita started to run forward to the injured bull boy's aid. Billy caught her wrist and hauled her back urgently.
Sorry, lass. I can be spared. You can't.
He dashed to Bob's side. Then he was returning, the torn and bleeding bulk of Bob draped over his shoulders. The bull boy moved his powerful legs as purposefully as he could, but it was apparent the much smaller talker was doing a real locomotion for both. Sensing somehow they were about to be cheated, the white beast screamed and began to charge.
Arms around!
Rita made gathering sweeps with her arms. Grant with his sin-eater in his right fist and his copperhead in his left, and Bridget holding Nobby's discarded vector, as well as her USP, back toward the common center, covering as best they could. Billy Handsome and Bob practically fell into the others.
Grab each other tight!
Great. Facing danger with a group hug.
A tidal wave of white skin and fangs and howling malice rushed in upon them.
You sure you know where we're going?
Tyree gave him a quizzical look.
I've seen a map.
As if that explained it all. The nighttime streets of Tanimbar were, if possible, more thronged than the harbor. Cain, Domi, and the four aborigines had taken a boisterous farewell from their Iban friends on the docks. The Sea Dayaks had been loudly disappointed when the outsiders had declined to join them for a headlong assault on the stews and a glorious night of gambling, drinking, serial whoring, and with any luck, the slitting of a few gullets. But they hadn't pressed the issue. Apparently, they were well acquainted with the eccentric ways of old man's people. The three aborigine men had packed their western-style clothes into rolls slung over their shoulders and donned flowing local garb. Johnny Korobori and Tyree had their dreads tied up with big swatches of cloth so that they looked as if they had masses of tentacles sprouting from the tops of their heads. As far as Cain could tell, the streets of the district they were in were so narrow and dark that the occasional light spilling from the odd tavern or late-night money-changing kiosk only served to make the stretches in between seem the blacker. They weren't the only ones abroad sporting such hairstyles. Cain would have been hard-pressed to name a style, sartorial or tonsorial, that wasn't in evidence, just in the clique or so they'd covered. Nor would he have sworn some of the shadowy figures they brushed up against didn't have tentacles sprouting from their heads. Cain himself still wore his pirate togs. There was one addition. He had a wavy-bladed dagger, which Red Flag had told him was called a kris when he presented it to him with great solemnity, thrust through his sash. In return, Cain had presented the Sea Dayak chieftain with something called a hobo tool, a sort of multi-tool composed of a folding knife, fork, and spoon set, along with sundries such as a corkscrew. They had boxes of the thing stashed away in the Cerberus armory, quite possibly for the very purpose Cain put this one to, trade goods. In any event, it may have been unnecessary. Despite their obvious obsessive fondness for cutlery, the Iban seem to have a serious surplus of daggers. Kane chose not to delve too deeply into what that might imply. Nobody, it seemed, took you seriously if you weren't displaying some kind of serious shank. Johnny now sported a Bowie-type knife with a 9-inch blade. Warboom Ben, a similarly sized weapon with a leaf-shaped chopping blade called a parang, which a lot of the Iban also carried. Tari had thrust through his belt a pair of weps like outsized forks with round hyperthyroid center tines, which Kane would have called sai, but which were known as jabang hereabouts. The two women were got up in loose but somewhat heavy head-to-toe garments, including trousers, brocaded blouses, and veils. The Iban had been Muslims before Skydark, but had backslid. But the women, who went happily naked, or near enough so as to satisfy even Domi's exhibitionistic urges back home, covered themselves on trips to town to avoid inciting the perverted lusts of degenerate city dwellers. Domi, who never gladly put on more clothes, had balked at first. But Mary Alice, giggling and glowing with the vivacity she hadn't shown before, got her to think of it all as a game of dress-up. At an intersection where five winding ways met, Tyree paused a moment in the fitful glow of a lantern in the form of a blue paper fish. Then he nodded and led them off down the narrowest and twistiest path of all, also, of course, the most ripely feculent.
City smells worse than the damn bay.
Look on the bright side. Less chance of drowning here.
The ground was slimy underfoot. No light showed at all, except little bats fluttered just over the outsiders' heads.
Now I know what it feels like inside an intestine. Except for the bats, that is.
You mean you never...
Shh! Kane was relieved when Domi's query was interrupted by Tyree halting before a low-arched door, set a foot back in a stone doorway, hunching down and rapping sharply, 3, 2, 3, backhanded. A moment, a squeal, and then a dim yellow shaft of light made a break for it as a brass peephole was opened. The light was momentarily blocked, sprang forth again, and then the door opened on hinges that protested far more loudly than the little vision port had, only to reveal the business end of a Kalashnikov leveled straight at Kane's navel.